radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Okay, welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. We're recording this down on the 24th of July down at the Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, Maryland, and where we've seen engines and trucks run up and down the road. So today's podcast, we're going to do a little rundown. We've had in the last 10 to 14 days, Brother Mike, we've had some rather serious accidents, including a couple that were caught on YouTube that almost looked like they were staged. So we're going to run down that. We're going to have a few questions from folks that have emailed stuff in to us. And we've got a live audience here today. We'll take a few questions from them. I'm going to talk a little bit about fleet planning, because as we wind down 2009, we're very shortly going to be running out of 2007 engines, looking forward to 2010, and that's going to make it a little bit more difficult. And then a segment where I'm just going to sit back, relax, enjoy the flight. Brother Mike is going to inform us on what kind of ground ladder complements we should have on ladder trucks. If it was hose coming off the back, you'd be hearing Tom, but since this is ladders, we're going to let Mike go take a whack at that. So, Brother Mike, what have we racked up here recently?
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks, Tom. Update, a veteran rescue squad member died in the line of duty in Vermont. Since we last spoke on the air here, it was a longtime Bennigan Rescue Squad member responding to emergency calls. His colleagues were called upon to save him, but the impact of the ambulance he was driving into a large pine tree made that not possible. He was traveling at a regular speed and really not sure at this point. The investigation's ongoing into that. Another story off the wire, pickup trucks temporarily replacing fire apparatus in Buffalo.
Okay, wait a second. That's a little too close to home here. But go ahead, read that, and then we'll review and comment on that.
We'll review and comment, yes. The city of Buffalo, having run out of spare units, have now taken dually pickup trucks and put portable ladders on roof racks over them and are responding with those in lieu of reserve or spare ladder trucks. Fire away, Brother Tom.
Okay, that hit the wire. That made the front page of the local newspaper, and I won't go into the political background of how the newspaper was tipped off to that, but just an observation, Mike, and not just unique to Buffalo, but as I was in a couple of good-sized major eastern departments here within the last couple of weeks, and there's two dynamics happening. One is that most fire departments' budgets, there's very little monies that they have that are discretionary, which means a chief or a support chief or somebody can make a decision where that money is going. So what's happening is the maintenance budgets are getting cut back because it's one of the few areas where people can see the lump sum of money they were supposed to spend and say, okay, we're going to spend less than that. We're going to make up the numbers here. And this is not indicative of Buffalo, but using round numbers, last year, you know, the maintenance budget was $100,000. We need to get a 10% cut. So this year you got $90,000. Well, if we're not buying new rigs, the fleet's getting more aged. One would expect, just like as we get older, you're going to spend more money on medical, not less. Fire trucks are getting beat up, specifically in the case of Buffalo and some other good-sized East Coast departments. Their reserve fleet, when somebody says reserve, that intends like saying, geez, I have a reserve car at home. You know, I have a car, my wife has a car. So we are a three-car family with only two people driving, and I've got a car that only goes out when I determine that I want to take the thing out. Well, in most departments, the reserve apparatus, because frontline units are either down because of accident or other repairs or deadlined and off the road, these reserve units, in effect, are on the street every day, which means that they're never sitting there ready to do something. They're always out there doing something. Well, in the case of Buffalo, and again, a department that I won't embarrass by mentioning their name, but I was in there within the last couple of days, and they had no reserve units, and they were running a spare pumper as a ladder truck, because that ladder truck had been out of service for 3 months. The city had no money to fix it. Now pretty close to where we're broadcasting from, down in a major Maryland department earlier this year, they had expended their maintenance funds by the month of March, and any apparatus that needed more than $100 worth of work, if it made it unserviceable, the unit was sitting out of service at a vendor's shop waiting for them to get into the new budget year in July. So in the case of Buffalo, I take this that they were reasonably proactive. They had no reserve aerial apparatus. They have units on order from, it happened to be America La France company that's having problems trying to build stuff. So this was a stopgap measure, because if they didn't utilize those, they'd have four members sitting around doing nothing with nothing to ride on. You might be able to relate to that in New York. It's a couple of times I know that you had mentioned to me that, you know, your frontline unit had a, had an issue, not enough to take the thing out of service. And when you called the shops, they said, well, you can come down and grab a reserve. But it's like, well, you could get it, do it, but I wouldn't recommend it. In the case of Buffalo, you know, the option was close to company, and you got two or three less ladder companies out running around on the street.
Well, I think this whole discussion is going to go to a point that we're going to look at later, the entire fleet. Our fleet, all back in the 80s, was not really in terrific shape in New York. And the new rigs that we were buying, because of the way that they were specified, necessarily weren't doing very well and required warranty work. And so that took an aged reserve and spare fleet and put that out on the street more and more. And like you said, it's not like the rig sits there for a month and then somebody decides to use it. It was basically being used as a frontline piece, although it had seen numerous runs and had many miles on it, 80, 90,000 miles with, you know, 1.5 mile runs. And as far as a fleet management, from a fleet management perspective, not only to have a newer fleet that's specified correctly, that's going to stay on the street and not beat up the reserve fleet, but also to have a strong reserve fleet. During 9/11, there had been a memo that went around that the then fire commissioner wanted to cut our reserve fleet by a full third, our spare and reserve fleet. 9/11 occurred. We lost upwards of 88 units in some form of disrepair, and it was the strength of that reserve fleet that got the New York City Fire Department up and running. Every company had a unit by Saturday night at 9 o'clock after the towers came down on Tuesday the 11th, much to the credit. It's a very unheralded story from our shops where retired mechanics came up from Florida in a car on their own time, no money involved, and worked 16, 18-hour days to help the mechanics that were on duty to get our fleet back up and running after that tragic event. And it was the strength of our reserve spare fleet that allowed us to do that. Had that been compromised, we probably would have been riding around in pickup trucks as well.
Yeah, so, you know, that's something where just, you know, there's a whole bunch of causes behind the issue. If you don't have a robust replacement program in place, and if you don't have one, it's going to probably be tough to convince your political, particularly the financial folks now, to go back that up. But we'll be getting to that a little bit later. So what else have we racked up lately?
Civilian rams into the rear of a Michigan fire apparatus, seriously injuring that civilian. However, the firefighters were all okay. And again, we spoke on the show many times before about civilian vehicles running into the back of trucks. There were a number of pictures out on the internet of a tower ladder in Connecticut that after 26 out of 30 days of rain, 26 days of rain out of 30 days, the operator put the outrigger jack in between the sidewalk and a curb, and the apparatus flipped over into the house a little bit. The basket, the boom ended up into the roof of the house that kept the truck from flipping over onto its side, and the outrigger jack was buried about 4 feet. Georgia fire apparatus rolls while responding. They were two firefighters had to be cut from a tanker that overturned en route to a structure fire. It was a 1982 International tanker. It was a full-time firefighter that was driving. The driver is recuperating at home from bruises suffered in the wreck. And then the other firefighter was treated and released, thank goodness. Kentucky fire apparatus crash. Appears to be a commercial truck that just looks like it rolled and just was disintegrated. A quote on the article, we are very lucky that none of our firefighters died in this Meade County Fire Protection District wreck. Firefighters from Station 1 were called to the scene of an injury accident. Five firefighters were on board this engine and ultimately needed rescuing themselves. They called five helicopters to the incident to transport the firefighters to a hospital. The truck was a 1993 apparatus. It was purchased by the city and given to the district when two departments merged. The truck was hauling 1,000 gallons of water, and it looks like it rolled pretty good in that photo.
You know, Mike, it's interesting that first when you had the unit was a 1982, so probably by any reasonable standards, that should be off the street. That one you just referenced was a 92, so we're getting a little better. Just recently, there was a fairly new tractor-drawn ladder down in Raleigh, North Carolina that flipped. What do you have on that particular accident? Because, you know, there's one that you really can't chalk that up to technology and age of the unit.
No.
That one looked to be when you can put a tractor-drawn and put it square on its roof. Leaves you a little suspect.
Yeah, we have some inside information on that the tractor operator and the tillerman were not in sync, Brother Tom, and one was going one way and one was trying to go the other way. And having had a little experience with that myself, if you sit in the tiller seat and you're in the cab of the truck and you can actually get the trailer from the rear wheels of the tractor back to the rear wheels of the trailer, you can actually get that piece. It can actually start rocking. And with the top heaviness of the ladder, if you jackknife the truck, which apparently looks like it happened as they were rounding a curb, it's pretty easy to flip over then, pretty unstable. And one of the very real concerns that I have after looking at three or four of these tractor-drawn wrecks was born in the fact that the tiller enclosures on every one of these that have rolled over have just absolutely disintegrated. Any comment from the industry side on that as to how it doesn't look like it's reinforced very well?
Well, the material construction, Mike, in the tiller cab is going to normally go in line with the material construction that you have on the trailer. So that being said, with just about everybody in the industry building an aluminum cab, and some people having options to do other than aluminum, for example, stainless steel in the trailer, one would assume then that the construction, if you have a stainless steel construction on the trailer body, that the tiller cab should be constructed of stainless as well, with some degree of reinforcement in the roof. But you're right. I can recall working with one department in New York, and when it got to talking about features in a tiller cab, because they were replacing an older TDA that was, you know, open style, and the one thing that they wanted to know is, they wanted to put like a skylight or a moonroof in the top of the tiller cab because they wanted the tillerman to be able to see out. Well, that's about akin to doing the same thing in the roof structure of your car. If you've got, you know, whether it be aluminum or stainless steel tubing going through the top of the tiller cab, that's great from a reinforcement standpoint. But most departments have an overall height issue. And if you've ever noticed, and we won't go brand specific here in the comment, we'll leave that to our listeners to look at. But if you look at the construction of some manufacturers' tillers, you will note that the aerial ladder, as compared to a rear mount or an old-style straight frame, the ladder does not sit level. Okay, from the turntable, the center line of turntable or rotation, back to the tip of the aerial. It actually is down in a canted position. Well, the reason for doing that is so the tillerman has better visibility, thereby being able to lower the height of the tiller box and ultimately the height of the cab of the tiller box to get in a certain door opening. And while all that has an advantage to make it fit the firehouse, which you have to do, if you're lowering the height of the tiller cab, then that somewhat limits the amount of physical structure you can have in that top of the roof, other than just saying we took a curved piece of metal and bolted it to the top of the side sheets, all right, for the box, Mike. So basically it's just there to cover you, but there's no substantial reinforcement. I know what you're saying in the case of that the Raleigh truck. When you look at the call it intrusion into that tiller cab, I'll bet that guy, we certainly hope that he was seated and belted, but I'll bet he was pretty heavily crunched, you know, over to the one side there to avoid having some severe damage and trauma done to his head.
Yeah, in that wreck, Tom, thank goodness that nobody was too seriously hurt. No non-life-threatening injuries. A couple last things, and then we'll move on with the rest of the show. For our listeners, the NIOSH report has just been released on the tower ladder accident in Kilgore, Texas, that killed two firefighters in January of was it this year? I'm not actually sure. Yeah, it was this year. Yeah, January of this year. That report was released explaining the investigation of what actually occurred there. We know that the bucket of the tower was caught under the building facade and that the operators of the truck were inexperienced. It was a brand new truck, and instead of releasing hydraulic power, they actually powered it up more. The facade gave away on the building, ejecting three out of the four firefighters that were in the bucket. One of them ended up between the building line and the bucket and was saved, but the other two fell over eight stories to their deaths.
You know, Mike, two things that struck me in that report that NIOSH, it was very poignant. One was that very specific about pointing to the lack of training of the operators in terms of their ability to have knowledge of the unit from an operational perspective, you know, beyond just being able to set it up. And as you've stated in the past, with a delivery training, you know, we're going to train you enough so you know how to operate it so you can't come back and sue the people that bought it. But that was one thing. And the second thing, very pointed about the specifics about design criteria in the basket and how that could have additionally led to other causative factors that caused the fatalities there. Any thoughts on that?
Well, there was some confusion as to who was responsible for putting some kind of straps or seatbelt or some kind of belt in the bucket for these folks to wear. It's one of those that I think is a gray area. And what struck me about it is that every rig delivered based on the 2009 standard has to have a safety vest on the seat. In 27 truck, we just got six safety vests delivered to us so that all our personnel have safety vests to operate on the highway. But yet there's really nothing in the standard other than to say that, yeah, it needs some kind of belt in the bucket to keep people in the bucket. But it's a very gray area as to the manufacturer. If they don't supply it, then it has to be supplied by the fire department that's going to own the unit. And it just seemed like maybe that was part of the problem here where it slipped between the cracks. And as far as the training, we've said this over and over again. 95 to 98% of the people that own aerial devices have a knowledge range level of somewhere between clueless and non-existent. And it's not necessarily anything that the fire service has done wrong. It's born in the fact that over time, you may have a department that got its first motorized piece in the 20s, and now we're four motorized pieces remote from that. And basically the only thing early on that happened is a guy from the factory dropped the truck off and said, this knob does this, this lever does this, this switch does this, have a nice day. And then it would be left up to the individual departments, depending on their workload and training, how good they were actually going to become with the truck. If you were not in a busy place and you did not train much, then you didn't get very proficient in the use of the truck. And so now we go, like Brother Tom said, to the year 2009, and you get some of the manufacturing reps in a more lucid moment, and they will openly admit to you that, first off, it's not training anymore. When we deliver aerial apparatus that specifies in the standard that you are getting a new delivery demonstration, they've actually taken the word training out of that standard. And the delivery agent, who 90% of those have never had a ladder truck to a fire, is going to explain to you how this truck works now, and they are going to point out every safety feature on the truck, every jack plate, every warning label, every safety switch known to man. And if you get them, like I said, in a more lucid moment, they will openly admit to you that the basic tenor of the whole demonstration is to try to get you, train you to how not to sue the manufacturer that built the truck. And there's a huge gap between getting a new truck and the fire ground training that's needed to safely operate the truck. And there are only a few people that I know of that actually provide a good fire ground aerial type training.
Mike, in this case, I like Chief Salka's comment. You know, if you're going to be a good company, you either got to go to a lot of fires or you got to train a lot so you can go to some fires. And it's just, to me, very tragic that these people were in a training scenario. This apparatus was not being used in any fashion at a structural fire or anything even remotely close to that. And, got themselves in some serious trouble, which unfortunately resulted in two line of duty deaths.
And finally, to wrap up in the you can't make this stuff up, we had some poor lady in Cape May County, New Jersey, sitting on her front porch when she was hit by an ambulance. The ambulance lost control and ended up taking her and her front porch out. You just can't make
this stuff up. Well, we're going to go to a couple of questions that came in and were emailed in to us.
This one's for you, Brother Tom.
I'll bet it's not about ladders.
No.
Okay.
No, because I would take that because you know little or nothing about ladders.
This is true.
Okay.
I climb them around my house. That's about the extent of it.
For my hose jockey friend, what is the NFPA language regarding hose bed covers being in place? I am getting beat up because my captain removed them off of our new engine when it was delivered. And now the peanut gallery is saying that we are violating part of the NFPA 1901 standard. Your thoughts. Hope all is well. KPT.
Okay. Well, the NFPA standard specifies that the hose bed cover, in terms of whether we're talking about now, let's start out at the front of the bus. All right. If you have a front suction well, trash line well, if you had hose wells on the running boards, a cover there where it says, hose areas have to be covered on all four sides, including the top. There, a seat belt or some type of restraining strap is acceptable. You don't necessarily need to cover it with the hinge piece of aluminum tread plate. If we're talking about a rear hose bed on an engine, Mike, something that you rarely see, other than maybe when you're following the engine on the way to the box, the hose bed cover needs to be provided by the manufacturer, permanently installed, and what the intent is that the department will continue to leave the hose bed covered once the unit is placed in service. Now, how you accomplish that cover, and if you talk to folks from the 1901 committee, and not to beat them up, but rightfully so, this, their first comment is, we don't tell you how to cover it. So if you're out on the West Coast, you're going to have to, because of your operating environment, you've got hinged, bifold, tread plate cover with fire-resistant flaps in the back that strap through a return loop, and the hose bed's completely covered, and you mechanically need to unattach several things to be able to deploy a supply line or a tack line.
That is because of what, Brother Tom?
Generally because of the wildland fire situations. I mean, you can't take an uncovered hose bed and go out in a wildland fire. You got flying brands around, and the next thing you know, you're part of the problem, not the solution, because your hose bed's lit off, all right? Now, whether your hose bed cover, if we're here in a central part of the country or East Coast scenario where we don't have wildland fires, you can make the cover out of anything, all right? And how it's attached is left between you and the manufacturer, whether you want to do the old hooks and loops or bungee cords or snaps or Velcro or whatever. And sometimes that just covers the physical top. And at the rear, people will use, cargo netting or different types of systems. So I guess if you have a hose bed cover and it's not doing what you intended to do, then you can either go back to the manufacturer and get them to make something that's going to fit your needs, or Click and Clack would say, shameless plug, pick up a copy of the Pennsylvania Fireman magazine, and there's three or four very good companies that routinely advertise in there, and that's their expertise. That's all they do is make hose bed covers, tarps, netting devices. So if what you got from your manufacturer, it's unfortunate you certainly paid for that, but if it's not doing what you need to do, or it's too cumbersome to then deploy the attack line and supply line, well, then go out and investigate a system that's going to work. But the intent of the standard was, it just wasn't going to be supplied with the fire truck. And then the first time you load all the hose up in the back, the cover ends up in the back tool room somewhere, under other stuff that you're not using. The intent is the hose bed's supposed to be covered to prevent any hose from self-deploying while the vehicle's being moved.
So, well, and I think there's liability issues to that as well, because the reason that this all came about is that a little girl was killed in the state of Pennsylvania when an 1¾-inch line came off of a crossley and the nozzle struck her in the head as she was walking on a sidewalk. And so certainly huge sums of money were paid out in that. And it would seem to me that now that the standard's in place, if you were to remove the hose bed cover and hose should fall off and hurt or injure somebody, it would be a ready-made lawsuit that even Bozo the Clown, as your attorney, could win you oodles and gobs
of money. Right, right. The person that's responsible then becomes the fire department and the political subdivision that oversees that. The manufacturer and the salesperson and their whole engineering firm, they're out of it. They supplied an attachment mechanism, understanding that, and this is a very fine point, but if somebody wants to play the proverbial Philadelphia lawyer, it's not uncommon for when your new pumper gets delivered, that hose bed cover is folded up and is part of the bill of lading of what came with the rig. It's probably not going to be attached to the pumper when it gets there, for sake of they didn't want the thing to fly off. And particularly if you had a Velcro, fastening mechanism, they wanted to make sure that the thing was in good shape and you acknowledged that you took and you received it. But the intent was not just to take it and then go, you know, throw it in a storeroom somewhere. And again, for the listeners, the next show that you go to, or, you know, Mike and I later on are going to tour around the show floor with, for every manufacturer that's on exhibit here down at the Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, if there's 10 pumpers downstairs, there's 10 different ways in which they've they've achieved that portion of the standard. There's not just one right way to do it, and everything else is wrong. So, all right, well, we've successfully motored through that one. Mike, here's one, and this has to do more with the operating the apparatus. I have a question about how we allow who we allow to operate our apparatus. We have a gentleman who belongs to our department that is a bigger individual and has gotten bigger. It's to the point that with the seat all the way down and all the way back, and the steering wheel extended all the way up and tilted fully forward, the steering wheel still contacts his stomach. Also, because of this, the individual is unable to turn the wheel. Sounds to me, Mike, so far maybe this guy's a candidate for like driving in the Memorial Day parade or something, okay? All right. A shuffling action is needed. This issue has been brought up as a concern by our members and is coming to a head because the individual wanted to be qualified on the Quint we just purchased. Well, this is even getting better here. Now we got a Quint involved, all right? He is also using the discrimination word. What rights does the department have, and can he be removed from the driving list?
The answer is clear and simple, and it has nothing to do with anything other than the use of seatbelts. If the department, which it should have a mandatory seatbelt, unlike airplanes where you can get seatbelt extenders, that's against the law when it comes to motorized vehicles. And so the driver must be able to put a seatbelt on. And it would seem to me from the way that was eloquently written that member could not, because of his physical size, put a seatbelt on. And so it has nothing to do with discrimination at all. It has to do with liability and personal safety, not only for him, but everybody on the truck and everybody on the road around him. So this person could call discrimination all they want. The reality is that it becomes a safety issue, and it's up to the jurisdiction having control of that situation to enforce a seatbelt policy, which would ultimately eliminate this guy from driving himself because he wouldn't be able to put the seatbelt on. And it's not a discriminatory issue at all. It's a safety issue. And if it were to be taken to court, if the firefighter were going to pursue that and claim discrimination, it would be a very easy fix for any jurisdictional lawyer to get that particular department out of that mess.
The other thought that I have, Mike, is taking away the gentleman's physical attributes, but one would also hope that department, like most, would require annual physical examinations for all their operating members. And even if this gentleman is is a permanent driver or he doesn't do involve with any interior firefighting, that to me would still seem that you would want to have those annual physicals conducted on people who are responsible for operating the apparatus and having the safety and welfare of the operating members with them. And if the gentleman might have some other, you know, medical condition that might be unknown to him and might come up in a fire department physical exam to, you know, be much better to not have the guy driving but have the guy alive than have this poor person have a heart attack sometime and then you're going to a funeral or a line of duty death incident because the gentleman was, you know, had some physical malady that maybe was unknown to him and unknown to everybody else other than, you know, could unfortunately be the, you know, maybe the butt of some backroom jokes about the gentleman's physical size. But if there were some issues there, I think you'd probably want to know about it.
Well, and the reality is when it comes to the lawsuit, it's going to be cheaper for the jurisdiction having control to fend off the discrimination lawsuit than it is to start paying out money in a apparatus vehicle wreck, which involves civilians and potentially injuries or deaths, which we certainly all want to help protect. And as far as just the physical attributes of this particular gentleman, and there are certainly many like him, he represents a clear and present danger to everybody, not only on the truck, but anybody driving around the truck, which could be your family or mine, and he needs to get out from behind a wheel and get off the road. And finally, one last question that we have from our website, and hopefully we'll be able to take some questions from our audience here at the Great Firehouse Expo. Dear sir, thank you for,
Was this
this question comes from California. Yeah, it's right in the front. Question regarding NFPA standards on command vehicles. We are in the process of purchasing a new command vehicle, and the addition of reflective striping has come up. I was hoping that you might be able to shed some light on the topic. Many thanks. Take it away, Brother Tom.
Well, the gentleman, from by the description, a command vehicle can mean a lot of different things to different folks. I mean, first thought was a command vehicle, a chief's vehicle or chief's buggy? Was a command vehicle something at the department, a larger unit that was maybe housed at the station that they were going to run for at major incidents? But one way or the other, I think no matter if it's a fire department vehicle and it's going to be on a public roadway, where possible, you should try to follow the NFPA standards with respect to striping down the sides, across the front of the vehicle, which sometimes on commercial vehicles is somewhat difficult because the only space you've got is the bumper area because of the physical size of the grills and the way the headlights are done. It's tough to get retro-reflective material across the front. But on the rear, you want to, wherever possible, I think, be following the standards with respect to the striping and the chevron striping. And certainly if it's going to be, even if it's a specialized vehicle, if you look at the NFPA standard in 1901, we've now got a portion of that standard relegated to talking about towed units, about trailers of different sizes. And trailers have to be striped. So I would think you want to have a command vehicle done the same way. And along that, just driving down here, Mike, from where I live in New York, coming down the other day after doing a couple of meetings, there were a number of units that I passed on the New Jersey Turnpike that were chief's vehicles. And I was surprised to see that while the chief's vehicles were all lit up with, you know, bar lights, all kinds of warning lights on the side, and all kinds of fancy gold leaf, a couple that passed me had zero retroreflective material. On the back, there was a huge advertisement for where that unit came from, its home location and home state. Not a bit of retroreflective material on the back at all. So,
well, this particular individual then wrote back again and said the current unit is a 2003 Ford 350 long bed with a diesel motor. This unit, as well as our two chief officer vehicles, which are the same type, is equipped with a 300-gallon tank and a 1250 pump. And we also have BLS EMS equipment on board. So, in essence, this vehicle is a fast attack vehicle. We use these vehicles for both command and initial attack, many times both at the same time. And after reviewing the NFPA 1901 and 1906 standard, it did not seem to
as if this area was well-defined or understood.
Well, in that case, they basically have, they may call it a command unit, call it whatever the local jurisdiction wants. I mean, you got a first response vehicle. You want to be having that with the appropriate amount of not only warning devices to meet the standard, but the reflective material and the chevrons on back. Like I said, in this case, since the standard exists, and the old thing I guess they used to say in some of the real old attorney shows on TV is they used to say, Mr. Shan, ignorance of the law is no excuse. All right, the standard's out there. There's the portion of the standard. And it kind of almost goes back, Mike, to the hose bed question. All right, it wasn't designed to put in there to say, we made you buy it, but once you go to use it, we don't intend you to use that device. You know, there's been a lot of debate, as we talked about with the manufacturer's reps in our podcast yesterday, about talking about the speed issue, all right? If you buy a unit that's got a 58,000 GVW, the standard says now you can only go 60 miles an hour. That didn't mean that the manufacturer had to build it to that, and then you take it down to your local Detroit Diesel Allison authorized guy, and he tunes it up, you know, in the engine, so you can now go back to doing 72 miles an hour. You know, that might make you momentarily happy until you hit Mrs. Smith, then you tell me, you know, what's going to be going on. All right, so we're going to take a quick break. Come back in a couple of minutes. This is Mike Wilburn, Tom Shan, reporting live with a audience here down at the Firehouse Expo in Baltimore on the 24th of July.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilburn and Tom Shan, live from Baltimore, Maryland at the Firehouse Expo in 2009. We're just briefly going to talk about a couple of fleet planning issues here in a second part of our program today. And for fleet planning, we mean about having a determined replacement schedule for everything that you own and operate, and giving the tight economic times, more importantly, having a financial stream to back up your replacement plan. A lot of departments in the past, maybe from when Mike and I entered the service, you know, people said, well, we replace rigs at 20 years. And then in some jurisdictions, that started dropping down chronologically to shorter periods of time because of the type of service and the runs that the company's got. If we take two fairly good-sized municipal departments on opposite ends of the coast, take Mike's operation in FDNY, by contractual arrangement, the apparatus – frontline apparatus cannot be in service for more than 10 years for a whole host of reasons. Out at the other end of the spectrum, you have, like in Phoenix, Arizona, they on paper for a number of years were trying to get 10 years up from an engine and 15 years from a ladder company. Now, unlike the New York environment where you've got a lot of runs but very, very short duration runs, short mileage runs, so you got maybe a lot of operating hours but low mileage. Out in Phoenix, it's just the opposite. You've got...
I would like to comment on that, Tom, because when I was out there, I was just floored. I was looking at a 9-year-old vehicle and a pumper in Phoenix, and it had 300,000 miles on it. I was floored.
Yeah, this data is a little bit dated, but the last one I knew, the average Phoenix engine company in their operating fleet, average, not the high, not the low, running almost 28,000 road miles a year. All right, one of my last trips out there, I rode with engine and ladder 50, and engine 50 was running a quote reserve or spare unit, and that rig had 279,000 loving miles on it. All right, so they found out that there was no way they could take a pumper and make it go 10 years in that operating environment. At that point, every engine would be pushing, as you mentioned, 300,000 miles. So they started looking and said, okay, we're going to try to reduce that down to 7 years frontline service, possibly 2 to 3 years of spare reserve service, depending upon its condition and the mileage. And then you start looking at your actual cost of ownership, and then it's going to go out of the fleet. A number of years ago, when Alan Bruncini, when Bruno was chief of the Phoenix Fire Department, developed the two-piece ladder company concept, all right, with having a ladder tender, or the local term, they just took that down to LT. If you're in if you're in the eastern part of the United States or you live in New York, people said LT, they're thinking you're talking about Lawrence Taylor, now, you know, retired linebacker for the Giants. Now, LT meant ladder tender, all right? It was a two-piece unit so that when the ladder company had to go out on a BLS or an ALS run, they put the four brothers on the LT because the operating cost per mile of that was about 20% of the cost of running a mid-mount tower or a tractor-drawn ladder, you know, running down the road. So it was their service delivery system that dictated, to a point, their fleet replacement policy. Now, in some cases, you go, you know, we'll, Mike and I will banter back and forth here for a while. You know, why do we replace a rig, Mike? Well, I know in some cases it's because it's due on the replacement schedule, all right? Right. In some cases, it's because maybe we're adding a rig and it's an additional service. In a lot of cases, it's maybe fleet replacement, but in the opposite direction. People had a standalone rescue or a squad unit and a standalone engine, and now because of staffing or money or a whole combination of things, we throw those two things together and we got a rescue engine, or down here in Maryland, it's a rescue wagon. I take the same thing over in your area of expertise, a ladder truck, all right? I had a conventional ladder truck and a conventional pumper. I'm in a small operating volunteer accommodation department. I don't have enough staffing to say that I can put four on the engine, four on the truck, and go out and do anything. So I'm going to throw that all together, you know, multiply it by five, and I'm going to put a quint out there. And in some cases, it's, as you've said in the past, why do we buy a rig?
Because we just can.
Because we can. Now, a lot of cases that's going away because we can means we don't have the funding stream for it. But for our listeners, you know, the issue is if you don't have a plan in place now that's approved by not only the people that operate the apparatus, but more importantly, much more important than it ever was, the people that control the funding stream to go adequately fund that plan. It's a great thing to have a plan and say, okay, we're going to replace the pumpers at 10 years, and we're going to place the ladder truck and the special service, the rescue or the light wagon or whatever it is, at 15 years. And it's a great thing to have that plan, and then you put everything in your fleet and say, okay, here's the year. If I have a rig and it's coming up on the 10-year mark for the unit, and I'm operating a 2001 pumper, one would then think, okay, well, in 2010, I'm going to start the specification process, get it on order at some part in 2010, and so we will take delivery in 2011 on the 10th anniversary of the engine. That's part and parcel of what we're talking about. But more importantly, if you don't have the funding stream, and I'd say in this case, with underline and highlight, an adequate funding stream to fund what your intention is of what you're going to go replace, then you really don't have a fleet replacement plan. You know, with what I do, in my full-time occupation, I go out and meet with an apparatus committee, and we're designing, you could just tell, we're designing the rig of their dreams, all right? And here's everything we want to do. And then you ask them at some point, without trying to be too pushy, but being polite, and say, are you guys, understand it? Here's kind of like the price structure we're in for this. It's like walking into an auto showroom where the guy has five different, car lines, and you could buy a car at $12,000, or you could buy a car at $72,000. Well, and that's a pretty wide range of, $50,000. $50,000 to $70,000. What's your level of threshold of pain here? What can you afford? And a lot of cases, Mike, what I'm finding is people say, well, we applied for a grant or we're doing this or doing that, and it's all a funding stream that's external to the fire department operation. It's not coming from within. And you say, well, okay, if you don't get the grant or this doesn't happen, the stars don't align properly, what's the plan? And invariably they'll tell you, well, we're going to wait till next year. Well, that's not a plan, all right? You know, if you charge something on your credit card, this is the best analogy I've come up with so far. This is not like the Little Rascals with that movie scenario, pay as you exit. If you charge something on your credit card and a minimum monthly payment comes up and you say, I'm a little tight this month and gas prices are going back up in New York, and a whole bunch of other things. My taxes are due. I got the car insurance, though. I don't think I'm going to make the minimum monthly payment. And then a credit card company comes back and says, Mr. Shan, you missed the July payment. What's happening? You can't say, I'm planning for that. I might give you some money come like November, if the Thanksgiving turkey doesn't cost a lot of money. That's not a plan, right? And what I'm finding is a lot of departments have a portion of the plan visioned of here's what they want and they'd like to buy it now, but there's zero backup from a funding stream standpoint to say this is how you're going to afford to do that. They're looking for somebody else to come in and drop a dime on them, as they would say, to go to go pay for it. In that case, Mike, to me, that's not really a plan. And I don't know whether it's a combination of whether you want to go blame in the economic climate of the country, or maybe it's just that, you know, is it that little pocket in that geographic area that those folks aren't plugged in to what's going on? But to me, it's very disconcerting, because then this goes back to what we talked about earlier with maintenance issues and a whole lot of other things. You know, if you're not going to buy new rigs when you think you need them based on your initial plan and there's not a funding stream for it, well, then what are you going to do to keep your fleet on the street to keep it serviceable so it meets the NFPA 1911 standards in all areas, not pick and choose and say, well, we're going to test the pump because we can do that ourselves, but, man, testing our hoses, really, that's a drag, and we're not going to do that, and we don't have money to go pay the outside company to do that this year, so the heck with hose testing. You know, we're just going to do the easy stuff. You know, it's like apparatus maintenance is more than just making sure there's air in the tires.
Well, I think there's a couple points, Tom. One is you may need to get help, and you know, certainly your local apparatus architect could help in this endeavor. The idea of going to the authority having control over funding streams and saying, hey, we need a new truck now, and drop in and say, you know, next year we want a new truck. Well, it just doesn't work like that anymore. The apparatus have become too expensive. There needs to be a long-range plan. And a lot of times in some of the work that Brother Tom and I do, we figure out 20 to 30 years so that not only the fire department knows when each of the units are going to be replaced, but also the authority having jurisdiction and responsibility for funding those purchases has a clue as well, so that they can plan ahead, and that there's no surprises, and that we know in 2015 that we're going to replace engine 3, in 2018 we're going to replace engine 2, and in 2020 we're going to buy a new ladder, and so that there's no surprises on anybody's part, and that we can properly fund these endeavors. The other reason to replace an apparatus, and Tom has done a great deal of work on this, is to find out how cost-effective the apparatus actually has been to run. In other words, what does the apparatus cost per year or per mile or per run to operate? And at some point in time, as the apparatus wears out and ages, it becomes basically a fiscal liability as far as fleet management is concerned, and we need to put that rig in reserve, or perhaps even sell that rig or get rid of it and buy new. There's a break point there. There's a price point where it's cheaper to buy a new truck for the next 20 years than it is to continually put Band-Aids and put money and parts in an older truck. And then with the apparatus industry in the state that it's in, where we've had three manufacturers basically go out of business in the last 24 months, what's the parts availability going to be as well? And so that may potentially affect that decision as to, well, are we going to keep that piece or are we going to try to replace it? Do we need to replace it? So there's a lot of factors that go in. In the case of my job in New York, obviously it's a contractual issue where my union, the UFOA, the Uniform Fire Officers Association, has in its contract with the city that I, as an officer, cannot ride in a rig that's more than 10 years old. And so the city can keep the rig for 10 years, 11 months, and 29 days, and then it has to go into reserve or spare status, or we would have what would be a grievable situation.
All right, well, we're going to move on to our last segment for this month's podcast. We're going to talk about ground ladder requirements and what you might want to be looking at if you're in the process of reevaluating your ground ladder complement on an existing unit, or if you happen to be in an enviable position of having enough money to buy a new unit. So I'll start out by saying that in the NFPA standards, all right, the minimum requirement on a Quint device is 85 feet. And if it is a non-Quint device, unit doesn't have a pump and a tank, it's 115 feet. Those numbers have been in place for a number of years, but if we go back in history, prior to any point in time in the 1990s, going way back to when Brother Mike and I started in the good old days. It started out at 228 feet. And over a period of years, that number has constantly come down. And it's a combination of a whole host of reasons. I view as one of the major ones is that as departments desired to take a traditional ladder truck that was just, if you look at, you know, people used to call them hook and ladder trucks. There's a unit on display down here on the floor at Baltimore that the name of the company is Hook Ladder and Bucket Company. And any people want to go back and view in fire service history when units were originally hand-drawn and then in later years horse-drawn, which meant we had more, you know, play on words here, horsepower, to pull this vehicle through the street. A traditional ladder truck carried ladders. It carried different hooks that were allowed to either scale windows and openings in buildings that were higher than the highest portable ladder, and hooks to be able to open up walls to be able to access hidden bodies of fire. And it was not uncommon for the ladder truck to have a series of buckets that they used, because the ladder guys back then in the mic, they helped out the engine guys. They tossed the buckets off, and we would get civilians to go take the buckets to take water from wherever it was to go fill up the hand pumps. That's, you know, a lot more cooperative in, you know, back then.
It's not now.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess there's no bucket on 27 truck then.
There is no bucket.
Okay. Right.
We don't touch water.
If we talked about a bucket on a truck now, we'd expect to see a towel ladder.
Right.
Okay.
We are real firemen. We don't touch water.
Right. Well, at any rate, so what happens is now enter that giant quint word, all right, and what happens in the dynamic and the design of the vehicle is now, and this is why Mike and I, we have to pretend that we like one another. It's now we have the engine guys fighting versus the ladder company guys. We want to put a pump on the ladder truck, and that takes up a physical amount of space. Well, if the pump guys win and they get that in there, the next thing we want is, well, now we got to have a water tank because we won't let me carry a bucket anymore. So now we got the fire pump and we got the water tank. And we've seen quints with 750-gallon water tanks on them. At that point, what you got is a glorified engine that happens to have a very expensive turntable and an aerial device on it that probably doesn't do anything very well. All right. So then if I went out and I've got the fire pump and the water tank, and we've got a couple of cross lays, and I've had innumerable meetings with people say, we just bought it to protect the truck. Well, to protect the truck, maybe you should hire somebody to train you how to position the truck, and then you wouldn't have to spend $80,000 to put a pump and water on it. But be that as it may, and I say in the political circles, at the end of the day, now we've got the pump, and we got the water tank, and we got a couple of cross lays. What do you think I want next, Mike?
Oh, lots of hose.
Got to have hose.
Lot of hose.
Right? Because now I got to be able to lay my own supply line. Right?
Lot of hose.
So now I've taken the space ahead of the turntable on top of the water tank, which what would you normally want to put there if it didn't have hose in the tank?
Portable ladders.
Portable ladders. Portable. Probably a good idea because that's why they call it a ladder truck. It carries ladders. Ladder trucks are not designed as supposed to be carrying hose. But when you get into the world of quints, those two dynamics fight one another because unless you want to buy, you know, a 95-foot tower that's 58 feet long, there becomes a practical standpoint at which the vehicle physically becomes too big. And honestly, in today's world, it becomes too heavy. We no longer can put this bad boy on the road because it doesn't meet the weight standards anywhere. And because you got water and that weight and the water tank and the hose and all this other stuff, the ground ladders have got to the point. It's almost like going through one of my favorite places in upstate New York, Bob's True Value Hardware Store, and you've got nuts, bolts, washers. I got all kinds of hand tools. I got electrical cords. I got outlets. I got a generator. I got lights. And the last thing I do because I've got my basket all full, somebody says, hey, Tom, you want to buy a ladder today? Sure. And it becomes an afterthought because it's the biggest thing you've got, and we design all this other, pardon my French, crap on the rig. And then when you show up at a structural fire, and even if Mrs. Smith and her kids are out of the house, we want a ladder four sides of the building. We can't do it with a single ladder company. Why? Because we didn't put enough ladders on there. So, Michael, I will acquiesce to you. I'm taking the water tank and the hose off there. I'm taking the pump off there. You got the whole thing to design from the cab back, buddy. It's yours. What kind of ladders do we want to put on a ladder truck if we're going to do any kind of job at a structural fire?
Well, first, and I go to class, and I ask my students when we do aerial and tower classes, What do you use the most on the truck? And it starts out with a tenet that Tom and I have always had when you are ordering a truck. You need to define the mission of the vehicle. What is the ultimate mission going to be of the vehicle? And you can't have a pumper, ladder, foam truck, tender, ambulance, tanker, rescue, light truck, air truck, and expect anything to work any kind of good. You really need to have a defined mission of the truck. And often when we're in class, I ask, okay, you have a ladder, your present ladder that you're going to replace. Do you use the main, the aerial device? What percentage of time versus the portable ladders on a truck? And almost always the class says, well, we use, for every time we use the main or the aerial device on the truck, we will use portable ladders 9 times. Okay, good. So then this thing has to carry a lot of portable ladders. Then the next question becomes, and as Tom alluded to, portable ladders are really for us. Yeah, once in a while we get a chance to rescue a civilian or two, but they're for us. And it pains me sometimes to buff fires and go and see that the RIT team or the FAST team is standing there in front of whatever's on fire, and there's no portable ladders in front of on all four sides of the building, realizing that the people that are in there in a firefight, if they get into a jam, are not going to be able to come out the front door the way that they came in, because that's why they're in a jam. And if we don't have several alternate means to reach the same space that they're in, then we're probably not going to do a very good job of saving them once they get in that jam. So we need to have the ability on a 2.5-story wood frame private dwelling, which is the bread and butter of any fire department, even mine in New York, we do many private dwelling fires. We need to have the ability to ladder all four sides of that building and a roof. And so I asked the class, okay, with your present portable ladder complement, can you do that? And of course, we have newer trucks that the ladder trucks are only required by the NFPA to have 115 feet of ground ladders. And then the question becomes, can you ladder successfully all four sides of a building and a roof with 115 feet of portable ladders? And the answer is an overwhelming no. Then what are we doing, folks? What are we doing? If you can't take your ladder truck, you're buying it for that purpose, and successfully ladder all four sides of a private dwelling and the roof, then what's going on? You've defeated the mission of the vehicle, and the mission that we stated in the beginning to define that mission was to buy a ladder truck. So here is the Mike and Tom list of portable ladders that we feel should be the minimum complement on a ladder truck to achieve laddering all four sides of a private dwelling in the roof. You need to have one or two 35-foot two-section extension ladders, one or two 28-feet two-section extension ladders.
Mike, let me just comment on the difference of the two-section versus the three-section ladder. When people buy the Quint apparatus, because the issue is the available length within the body to enclose the ladders, a lot of manufacturers will utilize three-section ladders because they are arguably shorter in length than a two-section ladder. And while it takes more banking width, they save on the length issue, thereby allowing them to dump the water tank and all that other stuff in there. Operationally, a three-section ladder, and let's face it, at least with the East Coast service, for our listeners out on the West Coast momentarily, you know, we're just going to be talking about aluminum ground ladders for the moment. There's only two suppliers of aluminum ground ladders to the fire service, right? Duo Safety up in Wisconsin and Alkalite down in South Carolina, right? You can pick up their catalogs. You can go online. You can physically, you can gain that information to look at the banking thickness and the length of these ladders. But more importantly, from a fire service perspective, because we're throwing these ladders to save our own, all right, is the weight of these ladders. So a two-section ladder is going to weigh typically less than a three-section ladder, and the advantage is it has operationally fewer pieces, parts, and things that can go wrong. And it's much easier to climb and operate. When you operate off a three-section ladder versus a two-section ladder, If you have these ladders available in your station, you're talking about, you know, doing a ladder drill. Just even throw the ladders up behind the station, all right, and get people to climb them up and down and look at the stability issues, right? They're both rated for the same weight rating because they have to meet the NFPA standards. But you'll find that a two-section ladder, by and large, right, has got less flex and just feels more stable and much easier to throw. So that's the evolution there, why we say, you know, is a three-section ladder bad? No. But where possible, always try to go with the two-section ladders, particularly if you're operating in limited staffing conditions because the fact they weigh less, right? Two people properly trained, just like no difference in getting the vehicle there and properly positioning the aerial device. Two people properly trained can throw a two-section 35 all day, every day. Three guys is great, but if you're only running a four-person truck and the inside team's already inside doing their stuff, you know, you just can't stand there by the back of the truck looking for the, you know, first free agent guy to come, you know, running by to say, want to help me throw to 35.
Some very good points, Tom. Excellent. We go on now with our list. 124, two-section extension. 1, 18 or 20-foot roof ladder. 2, 16-foot roofs. 1, 14-foot roof. 1, 10-foot folding ladder. And then 1... A-frame little giant type ladder. And if you outfit your ladder company with that complement, you are going to have somewhere between 153 to 216 feet of ground ladders, and you will be able to properly ladder all four sides of a private dwelling and a peak roof. And that will give you a great degree of flexibility when you reach the fire ground to be able to take and properly portable ladder the building.
Yeah, if you're going to work with prospective vendors to supply your ladder truck, when you're developing the list of, as we refer to it, you know, our little terminology, bullet list of the important things to you, list the preferred ground ladder complement on there, and as well as the tool and equipment list. Because again, on the NFPA standards, under the, you know, don't ask, don't tell provision, if you never go down the road of telling the manufacturer or the vendors you're choosing to work with you through the process what equipment you want to put on the vehicle, they're going to defer to the NFPA standard and say, when I package this whole vehicle, I'm going to give you a payload allowance. If we take all the equipment, throw it on a giant scale, you're going to be able to put 2,500 pounds of equipment on the truck. Depending upon your jurisdiction, how you operate with the vehicle, 2,500 pounds might not be sufficient, all right? And then you're going to find yourself getting into a weight issue, particularly if you're talking about tower devices, where they're automatically, the vendors defaulting to the heaviest front and rear axle suspension components because of what the vehicle's carrying to begin with. If you're running this unit, as Mike's had experience working with departments out on the West Coast, where they're running the ladder truck as a rescue ladder, that it's got, you know, rescue tool equipment and airbags and a whole bunch of shoring and struts and stuff, and you find out your equipment payload's up around 5,000 pounds, even though you might have physical room to put it on the truck, that's not the time to do that. Then go take the thing to the scales and weigh it. And on that, I mean, that off the subject of ground ladders, for the listeners and folks in the audience, one thing you want to do, if your department has not done that, all right, go home and in accordance with the standard, weigh every vehicle that you have in your fleet. Find a scale somewhere. Portable scales that the police department have are great. What works a little bit nicer if you have a local sand and gravel company or concrete place where they've got a flat scale they can run the trucks up on. The process is you go out there with a driver. He drives the front axle up on the scale. He hops off to get the front axle weight. Hops back in, pull the whole rig up on the scale. You get the whole vehicle weight, all right, again, with him hopping out. Then you do it one last time with him taking the front axle off, and now that's just the rear axle's on. He hops out, and you get the weight there. And you simply then, you then know what the front and rear axle weights are individually, what the whole vehicle weighs, and you verify that it is legal with respect to what the axle carrying capacities on the apparatus that you have, all right?
That there's a tag for our listeners. There's a tag that's usually in and around the driver's door somewhere that will give the front axle rating, the rear axle rating, and then the overall GVRW, which is a gross vehicle rate weighting of the entire vehicle. And that's where you compare those weight tickets to those axle weights. You compare them to that tag that's in and around that area.
You know, people in the past thought that, you know, the mini pumpers of the day were being very susceptible, lighter weight attack vehicles susceptible being overweight. Mike did a fleet evaluation for a department in upstate New York. They had, what, 17, 18 rigs in a fleet, and they had 7 units that were overweight just sitting in the fire station, just the way they were, including a 100-foot tower, all right, that was overloaded on the back end, and these guys were running up and down a road jolly, you know, every day, all day, and were completely naive to the fact that these rigs are overloaded. And that's the first point of danger. If, God forbid, you get involved in any kind of accident, it doesn't have to be a personal injury accident, a fatal accident. It can be a, you know, fender bender with Mrs. Smith as you're out driver training on Sunday in all good conscience, and you clip Mrs. Smith in his Toyota as she's leaving Einstein's Bagels with the, you know, coming from Sunday Mass. And, you know, the first thing the police are going to do, all right, are going to impound the vehicle, and the very first thing they're going to do after they check the driver and possibly have to, you know, blow him in for a drug and alcohol test is weigh the vehicle. And if it's overweight, as Mike said,
it doesn't matter until it matters.
Doesn't matter until it matters. It's game, set, match right there. So that's wrapping up our podcast here from firehouse.com at Firehouse Expo. We look forward to engaging our listeners and our audience here in the future. If you have any questions at all, please send them into podcast@firehouse.com. For Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, this is the Apparatus Architects. Stay safe out there.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.